On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The celebrated novelist, poet, and screenwriter Sherman Alexie grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation, a son of the Spokane and Coeur d'Alene tribes, made it through a tough childhood and stepped out early with trademark bravado in his first novel, The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. He wrote Ten Little Indians, the screenplay for Smoke Signals, and a whole lot more. Now he's sending a troubled young half-Indian on a time-traveling American pilgrimage through Little Bighorn and Wounded Knee and Future Terrors, too. Up next on Point, Sherman Alexie on his new novel, Flight. Joining me now from Washington, D.C., is Sherman Alexie. He's author of six novels, a dozen books of poetry. He wrote the screenplay for the movies The Business of Fancy Dancing and the 1998 Sundance Award-winning film Smoke Signals. The New York Times calls him a bold writer who goes straight for the aorta and calls his new novel, Flight, raw and vital, often raucously funny. Sherman Alexie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Are you tired of being called a Native American writer? Do you graduate from that one day, or with books like Reservation Blues and Ten Little Indians and all the rest, is it always with you?
It's always with me. That's who I am. I don't mind. I guess the only problem with that is when people don't refer to John Updike as that Northeastern white writer, which is what he is.
Yes, he is indeed. No question about it. Introduce us to Zitz, if you would, the young man at the heart of this new book.
Zitz is a 15-year-old, half-Irish, half-Indian orphan who, when we meet him, is in his 21st foster home and has gone through the system and been abused in mental and emotional and physical ways. So he really is, when we meet him, on the border. Borderline personality, disassociated, dislocated, and is easily manipulated by a kid named Justice into committing a horrible act of violence.
And what's going on in that meeting? Zitz meets Justice, and pretty soon they've got pistols in hand. What's the appeal of this boy named Justice who's ready to take Zitz right off the rails?
Well, Justice has, you know, a revolutionary intellect, and he really manipulates Zitz by quoting and using statements from great revolutionaries and philosophers of the past. And he also trains him. One of the ways in which you have to train human beings to kill other people is to eliminate their fear of that. So Justice gives Zitz a couple of guns, a paint gun and a real gun, and they go out into the Seattle night and they practice killing people. They come up on strangers and shoot them with a paint gun. So after doing this for a while, it sort of deadens Zitz to the idea of actually harming people and makes it easier to use the real pistol later.
And Justice, this new pal kind of on the lam with him in the night in Seattle, is also feeding him a sort of ideology or a conceptual framework to use that gun. He talks a lot about the ghost dance and gets the half-Indian Zitz to really think about it.
Yeah, which is interesting that it took a white guy to convince an Indian boy that the ghost dance is real. The ghost dance was the vision of a Paiute and Methodist minister in the late 19th century named Wovoka, who convinced a whole bunch of Indians that if they danced the ghost dance, it would send the white people back to where they belong and that it would resurrect all the dead Indians. It was a very apocalyptic vision, very Christian-influenced, actually, and it ended up creating a lot of tension for the United States government and led to the massacre at Wounded Knee of ghost dancers. And Justice convinces Zitz that in the present day, a 21st century ghost dance would be for Zitz to walk into a public place and kill a lot of people. And in doing so, that would resurrect his parents.
And that sends Zitz off on a great journey through time and the American Violence, the American Soul, and a whole lot more. I wish you'd read just a bit for us, Sherman Alexie, from there. Maybe page 34 in the new novel, Flight, where Justice prompts Zitz to his own massacre.
Justice asks me, "What would you do if the ghost dance is real?" His question echoes in my head. It stays there, and I want to give Justice the best answer, the only answer, the answer he wants. "What if the ghost dance is real?" Justice asks me again, and again. The question crawls into my clothes and pushes its way through my skin and into my stomach. The question feeds me. Do you think the ghost dance is real? Justice asks. After hearing that question 1,000 times, I finally have the answer. Yes, I say. Justice laughs and hugs me. I am so proud. I feel like I finally deserve his love. Okay, okay, he says. Now you can dance. Now you understand. Now you have the knowledge. Now you have the power. So what are you going to do with that power? I stare at the pistol in my hand. I'm going to start a fire, I say. Yes, Justice says, and keeps on hugging me. He loves me, and I love Justice. The next day, during lunch hour, I stand in the lobby of a bank in downtown Seattle. 50 or 60 people are here with us, with me. Men, women, and children of many different colors. I hear 4 or 5 different languages being spoken, and I guess these people have many different religions, but none of that matters. I know these people must die so my mother and father can return. I breathe, try to relax, and pull the reel and paint pistols out of my pocket. I say a little prayer and dance through the lobby. I aim my pistols at the faces of these strangers. They scream or fall to the floor or run or freeze or weep or curse or close their eyes. One man points at me. You're not real, he says. What a strange thing to say to a boy with a gun. But then I wonder if he's right. Maybe I'm not real. And if I'm not real, none of these people are real. Maybe all of us are ghosts. Can one ghost kill another ghost? I point and push the reel and paint pistols into the man's face, and I pull the triggers. I spin in circles and shoot and shoot and shoot. I keep pulling the triggers until the bank guard shoots me in the back of the head. I am still alive when I start to fall, but I die before I hit the floor.
And that's just the beginning of Sherman Alexie's new novel, Flight. I mean, it makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. You can kind of feel the way that a terrorist, a massacre perpetrator, can be led to that right here. But in this case, it's the beginning of Zit's time-traveling kind of search through a lot of history, the Little Bighorn and Wounded Knee and flight school, terrorism, and all the rest. What is the hole in the heart of this young man that he's trying to fill in that journey, Sherman Alexie, this half-Indian, half-Irish young man? What's the hole in his heart?
Well, the hole really is the absence of his father. His mother died when he was 6, but Zitz's father left him shortly after he was born. So I think everything that Zit's done is try to fill the father hole inside of himself, and I think that's why he's so easily manipulated, that even another teenager like Justice can become a father figure to him.
He remembers his mother and almost wishes he didn't. Remembers her singing songs from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the old band, and says he wishes he could almost shake her out of his head because that comfort and love has been so lost to him. But his father, the Indian, he says, my father was an Indian from this or that tribe, you write him saying, from this or that reservation. He says he was like a cruel magician to me about disappearing about 2 minutes after I was born. This or that tribe, I mean, you're the Native American writer, but at least at the outset, in this boy's mind, his Indian heritage is sort of random and what, this or that tribe, he could scarcely care in a way.
Yeah, I mean, everything about his life is random. I mean, his mother was Irish, and he doesn't know anything about that. As he says at one point, you know, I'm half Indian and half Irish, which would be the coolest combination in the world if somebody was around to teach me how to be Indian or Irish. So what he's really missing is some sense of connection to any part of his past. So he really is, as he calls himself, a human solar eclipse.
You send him on a search to figure out American violence. What set that up as a topic that you wanted to explore?
Well, a few years ago, I watched a documentary about 9/11, and they interviewed one of the flight instructors who taught the terrorist how to fly. And as I was watching it, I realized I'd never heard a word from those guys. This was the first time. And he was talking about how the terrorists would come to his apartment. They were his friends, and they would, you know, sit around and drink and tell stories and sing songs. And once in a while, the terrorists would be too drunk to drive home, so they would sleep on his couch. And that personal betrayal set against the backdrop of that epic crime just really stunned me and saddened me. It was so tragic. And, you know, as I learned more about the terrorists themselves, I mean, I think the romantic image from certain views is that those 19 guys were sort of poor men, poor guys, you know, freedom fighters, revolutionaries. But when you look at their backgrounds, they were all middle and upper class, college educated, cosmopolitan guys. So who could blend into European and American culture very successfully. So it just got me thinking, how can you take somebody like that who has a certain amount of privilege and convince them that murdering thousands of innocents is the way to protect their culture? Mm. So that was really where the book started. And then I started thinking, what would it take to convince a Native American boy to do the same kind of thing?
Julie is calling from Farlington, Connecticut. Julie, you're on the air with Sherman Alexie.
Hi, Tom. I'm a huge, huge fan of Sherman Alexie, and I'm honored to be able to ask him questions, so thank you very much. And I guess my question is how Mr. Alexie approaches his work in terms of its purpose. Does he see its purpose as simply to ask provocative questions or to simply tell good stories or perhaps to heal wounds? Or how does he approach the purpose of his work?
Sherman?
Well, that's a really interesting question. My career has changed dramatically. It's gotten pretty big. And this tour has really pointed out that I have quite a bit of pop culture power for someone who is a literary writer. And I have a lot of influence in the Indian world, especially. So I'm quite aware of the social and political power of my work and its influence. So as much as you don't want to be as an individual artist, I'm also aware of my sort of tribal and community responsibilities. So,
you've got the power. What's your purpose in it then?
In fact, in this book in particular, Flight, it has what I would call a potentially redemptive ending. There is some sense of hope. And I had written various drafts of the ending, the tragic ending, the more ambiguous ending. And I just decided that because of that sort of political influence and social influence I have, especially in the Indian world, I didn't want to send a tragic ending out there. I thought that was just the wrong thing to do. And that may not have been the most artistic decision, but it ended up being the best social decision. So that's sort of the position I'm in the Indian world.
But do you think in large terms about your purpose? I mean, to Julie's question, do you see yourself, you chose that ending. Is that because you're trying to use her word, trying to mend American Indian culture or to mend relations between the Native Americans and everybody else? Do you have that kind of grand capital P purpose?
Well, last night I met an Indian man who's working here in Washington, D.C., and he's 27 years old now. And he told me, I first read one of your books when I was 12. And that's what really made me start thinking about going to college. And now I'm here, in Washington, D.C., having graduated from college, and I'm working for this certain government institution. And, I'm here because of you. And you sit there and you hear that and you realize what influence I can have, my books can have. So, I'm quite aware of that ending. And for all the lost boys out there, all the lost Indian boys and other lost boys of whatever color, I know if people get this book into their hands, maybe it'll help.
Julie, thanks very much for your call. Let's take a call from Dan in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, what do you think?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm from Spokane, but I live in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and I'm Irish and Indian, and Sherman and I know the same people. It's kind of odd to hear this living in the middle of nowhere, because it takes me right back to the res and all of that.
To the reservation, the same reservation where Sherman Alexie grew up, the Spokane?
Well, I'm from Spokane. Actually, I lived right up the street from the Indian Community Center. My grandfather and my father and my uncle had a lot to do with that. He knows where it's at the bottom of the hill. Across from the dorms at Gonzaga, where they used to have the powwows. So, I was involved with all of that and running around. I knew some of his cousins, and it's back in the day. I just want to ask if this is, Sherman, is this boy actually based upon a real person? Because really, the interesting thing here is if you're Native American and another race, like Indian and Irish, if you belong to two races, you really don't belong to any race at all. I mean, it really is a dichotomy between the two. I can't tell you that if you are Native American and Irish, you shouldn't drink. It's kind of a bad combination because, a lot of people go down in flames with that. But it's interesting that you would actually pick out somebody who, a country that has been subjugated like Ireland, and, you know, just the disparateness of the whole thing. Mm. That's my question. I'll take it off to you.
Yeah, Sherman, you're singing Dan's song there with an Indian-Irish protagonist. He wants to know who have you based it on? Why?
Well, it wasn't on Dan. I don't know Dan. But the reason why I made him half Irish is because of that book, When the Irish Became White, which I read, and I was really astounded by the notion of that assimilative process. So, and, you know, historically speaking, one of the jokes, you know, I always tell is that the Irish are the Indians of Europe. So that it was a historical connection that really made me want to do that, like Dan said. But in terms of being bicultural, that's one of the issues I address in this book. And that's one of the reasons for the redemptive ending, too, is to point out that, you know, the Irish and the Indian stuff, while very important, and while Zitz needs to explore that, he also realizes and finds out that there are other ways of being tribal and looking at the world and finding family. And I don't buy into that idea anymore, that just because you're a member of two races means that you don't belong to either one. That's really fundamental, and flight is anti-fundamentalist.
But in your case, you haven't had to straddle that. I mean, you're not... You're all Native American, as I understand. If that, I'm not sure how important you consider that to be, or what it means.
I had the most typical sort of Indian background. I had a you know, grandfather who was part white, but he died 20 years before I was born. So I was raised completely by Indians on an Indian reservation across the street from the tribal school.
Mm-hmm.
So I am, you know, as Indian gets, I suppose, but. You know, being an Indian and living in the United States, I'm bicultural and biracial no matter what. Everybody
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've dealt with many of those assimilative issues, and I've just come to the point where my ethnic identity is one part of who I am, but I belong to, you know, hundreds of other tribes, too. The bookworm, obsessive-compulsive, workaholic tribe is probably my primary identity.
Right. Yeah, let's see the shield for that. There's a great, very admiring review of the book in the Native American Times, which I had not read before, from Independent Indian News. It's called, written by Ernest M. Whiteman, the third. And I know you're a part-time comedian, and I wondered if in that byline is that a joke, or but never mind.
No. There's when you look at Indian names, you know, they're always physical in the sense that they measure a physical characteristic or a physical action. So I imagine that Ernest's ancestors either killed white guys or they assimilated early.
Well, he writes, and he likes the book a lot, but then he writes this, and it's interesting. He says, here's what disappointed me about the story. In Flight, Sherman Alexie presents the Native American in very sad and rugged forms. The only two strong Native characters that I remember are Zitt's father, a raging alcoholic with demons, and Crazy Horse, the only Indian man that Indian men are allowed to be in love with. He says there's no strong, positive, strong Native characters to act as the flip side. You know, he says we get the drunk father or we get Crazy Horse in a very romanticized, almost Christ-like visage with golden eyes. What do you say to Ernest Whiteman in the Native American Times there?
Well, I'd say he's being ethnocentric because none of the white guys get off easy in this book either. If anything, the book is very much critical of males and masculinity in general, not just Indian men. So, you know, there's sexual abusers in here, white guys and very violent white men. So I think Ernest was focusing strictly on the Indians without ever considering the novel holistically. And in terms of Crazy Horse is a Christ-like figure, a savior figure for the Sioux and for other Indians in general. And you know, I mentioned him in the book during the Battle of the Little Bighorn because he is this mystical figure to Zitz, who's self-stated entire education of Native Americans came from, you know, the Discovery Channel.
Mm.
So it's very much a Discovery Channel interpretation of Crazy Horse that Zitz represents in the book.
He's got abuse at the hands of a white foster parent in his background. We hear that traumatic moment where he sees himself in the bank shooting, and suddenly he's disassociated and he's out there time traveling. How did you choose your destinations here? Describe for us the big time tour he takes, Sherman Alexie.
Well, you know, I knew it was going to be a lot of Native American history, so I just picked the most archetypal moments in Native American history, the Battle of Little Bighorn, the massacre at Wounded Knee. Those two events really define the Indian Wars. You know, there are other smaller events and smaller tribes engaged in the similar events, but it really is, in terms of pop culture, Little Bighorn and the massacre at Wounded Knee that define who we are.
You make Zitz, though, an FBI agent at Wounded Knee. That's some way to wake up when you start time traveling as a young half-Indian man.
Yeah, with the political activism of the 1970s, there was all sorts of very conflicting and contradictory behavior on the part of the FBI and the United States government, the tribal government, and the American Indian movement, the political activists. There was a lot of violence and on both sides. And as Zitz says at one point, how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they say the same things to justify their violence?
Your own sons asked you about that, which, as I understand, got you on the trail of this story.
My youngest son asked me once, we were watching the news, and he said, how come if everybody wants us to get out of Iraq that we're not out of Iraq? And then I tried to explain it to him, and using, you know, both sides' arguments, and it made absolutely no sense to him. And I realized, you know, you're right. It does make no sense whatsoever. And so I wrote this book as sort of a parable, as a way to talk to him, even though he's certainly not going to read it for years, but to talk to him about American violence and violence in general, and its contradictions, its inherent contradictions.
Your young traveler is there at Wounded Knee in the 70s. Then he's all the way back in the 1870s at Little Bighorn on the eve and through the attack by Custer and Custer's downfall. I wish you'd read a little bit for us, if you would, from the top of Chapter 8 there, Sherman. Maybe you could set it up and take us on the time tour with young Zitz.
Zitz drops into a body of a little boy in the camp at Little Bighorn, and while he's there, a big Indian man picks him up, and he realizes that he's dropped into the body of a young boy whose father is carrying him through camp, and that's where we'll start here. Happiness never lasts long, does it? As my new father leads me through camp, I realize this cannot be heaven. All these old-time Indians are doomed. They're going to die of disease, and they'll be slaughtered by U.S. cavalry soldiers. They'll be packed into train cars and shipped off to reservations, and they'll starve in winter camps near iced-over rivers. The children are going to be kidnapped and sent off to boarding schools. Their hair will be cut short, and they will be beaten for speaking their tribal languages. They'll be beaten for dancing and singing the old-time Indian songs. All of them are going to start drinking booze, and their children will drink booze, and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren will drink booze, and one of those great-grandchildren will grow up to be my real father, the one who decided that drinking booze is more important than being my father, the one who abandoned my mother and me. That's what is going to happen to all these old-time Indians. That's what's going to happen to me. This is what justice was always talking about. Old-time Indians were so beautiful, and they were destroyed. It makes me angry. I want to spit and kink and punch and slap. I want to cry and sing, but I cannot use my voice. And then my father stops to talk to a funny-looking Indian guy. I listen to them talk Indian. I don't know exactly what they're saying, but I do know they're arguing. This new Indian guy is short, barely taller than I am, and he's very pale, almost white-skinned. In fact, he's got patches of skin peeling off his back, chest, and arms. This Indian is so white he gets sunburned. His hair isn't black at all. Nope, it's light brown, and some strands of it are almost blonde. He's got a single eagle feather tied into his braid and white lightning bolts painted on his body. Oh my God, this pale little dude is Crazy Horse, the strange man of the Oglalas. Yes, this is the famous mystical Indian warrior who killed hundreds of white people. This guy was the greatest warrior ever. I am looking at Crazy Horse, the magical one. Bullets couldn't hit him. He could never be photographed. He was a holy ghost to the Sioux Jesus. Well, sort of like Jesus. I mean, Jesus didn't kill anybody, you know, so Crazy Horse was like Jesus if Jesus had been a warrior. I am standing right next to him, and his eyes are gold-colored. I think the greatest warrior in Sioux history is a half-breed mystery. I think this legendary killer of white men is half-white, like me.
Sherman Alexie reading from his new novel, Flight. Ernest Whiteman in the Native American Times suggests that Crazy Horse is the only Indian men are allowed to be in love with. Do you know what he means by that?
Well, it's certainly about worshiping the past and worshiping a certain kind of Indian. Ernest is a cartoonist and an artist, so I'm sure he wishes that more books were celebratory of that aspect of Native maleness. And
that aspect being what, the humor side? Or
the humorous side, the more passive, peaceful side, the spiritual side, rather than the warriors.
You call this book an exploration of American violence. I mean, Native Americans know American violence like almost nobody else. I mean, they were the targets of genocide. So what's the perspective that you come up with when you explore American violence from that starting point?
Well, you know, it's a very difficult thing to talk about, because even at Little Bighorn, which is mostly seen as a victory of the oppressed against colonial forces, and it was that, but at a certain point during that day, and it's detailed in the book, the Native Americans started committing horrible atrocities against the survivors and corpses of cavalry soldiers, and tortured them and mutilated them. And so at some point during that day, a military victory became a series of war crimes. And so, you know, who are the good and bad guys when that stuff happens? At that moment when an Indian mutilated a cavalry soldier's body, I think the distinction between good and bad disappears. And so when I look at American history, when I look at our past, our collective and individual past, all those moments happen. There's always that switch when whatever you want to call good becomes bad.
And when you
look at the contemporary situation, Iraq, whatever our good motivations there are quickly vanquished by the bad things we do, the torture, the subjugation of civilians. So, you know, how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad?
Sherman Alexie joins us from Washington. Let's listen to just a little bit of his 1998 Sundance Award-winning film Smoke Signals, screenplay written by Sherman Alexie. The main character, Thomas, builds a fire, starts his life literally with a fire. He's thrown out of a burning window by his parents in order to save his life. Then ensues the comic, sometimes harrowing story of a road trip off the reservation.
On the 4th of July, 1976, my mother and father celebrated white people's independence by holding the largest house party in Coeur d'Alene tribal history. I mean, every Indian in the world was there. And then at 3 in the morning, after everyone had passed out or fallen asleep on couches, on chairs, on beds, on the floor, a fire rose up like General George Armstrong Custer and swallowed up my mother and father. I don't remember that fire. I only have the stories. And in every one of those stories, I could fly.
From the 1998 Smoke Signals screenplay by Sherman Alexie, it came from a story in his first big book that came out, the collection, The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fist Fight in Heaven. Sherman Alexie is with us from Washington, D.C. Eric is on the line from Edisto Island, North Carolina. Eric, you're on the air with Sherman Alexie.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be on the radio with you. I have a quick question about the possible semi-biographical information that's in your stories, like in the story Indian Education, the continued characters that are in some of your other stories, like in The Toughest Indian in the World, some of the other stories in that, about the basketball player, the pseudo-intellectual. What can you tell me about that?
I am very much definitely a pseudo-intellectual. So, well, a lot of the earlier work is very autobiographical. As the years have gone on, I have less and less to say about my own past and have written much more fictional characters. So Zitz is really a long ways away from me in terms of who he is and his past. My parents, you know, were married for 45 years until my father's death 4 years ago. So I lived in a fairly stable household that way. So, I was not an orphan. I was never in foster care. In fact, my family, grading on a curve, was one of the more stable on my reservation. So we actually took in a lot of foster kids ourselves and ended up raising a couple of cousins as siblings.
You bring a quote from Kurt Vonnegut right into the front of the new novel, Flight, from Slaughterhouse-Five, and there is a very definite kind of Billy Pilgrim time-traveling approach to this book. How do you see Vonnegut? Is he an inspiration for this book?
Vonnegut is an inspiration for my whole career. Mm-hmm. I read Slaughterhouse-Five in high school, and while it didn't prompt me to become a writer then, I certainly really identified with his sense of humor, his satirical take, his ability to make jokes at anything, you know, even at the concept and the reality of genocide. And so when I started writing this book and I started thinking about the ways in which I could get my character through history, Slaughterhouse-Five, of course, popped into my head. So the first sentence, in fact, at one point was, you know, Zitz just came unstuck in time. That was my working beginning. So it is very, very much an homage to Slaughterhouse-Five, minor replica.
Yes, indeed. And it reads that way. And I mean that as a compliment in many dimensions. But then you turn to Melville ultimately. Call me Zitz is an opening line. There's your down market pop version.
Yeah, exactly. The first sentence of the book is Call Me Zitz, and certainly I wanted that to be humorous to set the tone for the book, but I also wanted to, and I don't know that a lot of people have picked up on it, to point out the epic nature of a teenager's complexion, that especially somebody so disfigured as Zitz, with such an incredible case of acne, that his relationship with it is every bit as obsessive and self-destructive as Ahab's relationship with the white whale. So, and I don't think people have picked up on that. And I just keep thinking, obviously, all of my book reviewers have had good complexions.
But if they only knew.
If they only knew. And I had a terrible complexion growing up. I'm 40 years old, and I still deal with adult acne. So my relationship with my skin is intense.
And when he finally finds salvation, it's at the hands of a woman who's prepared to help him with that very real kind of issue of disfigurement. I wish you'd take us into the portion where he travels into the body and life of a flight instructor who ends up training terrorists. There you catapult us ahead out of the 1870s and into some kind of future that we already feel like we know too well from 9/11.
Yeah, and you know, as I had stated earlier, that was the original impulse for the book, the real flight instructor. So my fictional flight instructor, as we meet him, is engaged in an extramarital affair and gets caught by his wife, while with the other woman. And so it's the personal betrayal of a husband against a wife set against a backdrop of the other personal betrayal of a terrorist who befriended this flight instructor and then used that knowledge to fly a plane into rush hour in Chicago, Illinois. So it's those two things together, all that personal betrayal and that epic crime and the wondering, you know, how much difference is there between all of that? Is one sin larger than another or not? Or are they the same kind of sins?
Let's go to Kathy in Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air with Sherman Alexie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mr. Alexie, I just wanted to tell you how much I like your writing. I've read pretty much everything you've written except this new book, and I loved Smoke Signals. I have a son who's part Potawatomi, and he has also really liked your writing and liked Smoke Signals. And
what is it you like about it, Kathy? What do you like?
I find it very moving,
mm-hmm.
and it really opens my eyes to points of view that I would not otherwise see.
Sherman, there's a thank you from a fan.
I'm married to a Potawatomi, so.
And I grew up on the Kickapoo Creek, and my family displaced Potawatomis. There's the American story. Sorry.
So you better send my wife about $20 then.
I mean, but that is the American story, though. We are all woven together in the fabric that you're waving here.
Well, that's one of the things that you know, like when the caller earlier was talking about living, you know, feeling that because you were Indian and something else that you didn't belong to either tribe. And one of the things is that, you know, people talk about assimilation like it's a one-way process, but the fact is that Native Americans, all other minority groups, have been influencing American culture just as much as it's been changing us. You know, it's an ambiguous and amorphous relationship. The assimilative process is very complicated and diffuse and diverse. And I know that we Native Americans have changed European Americans, and we will continue to do so.
I wish you'd speak more to that, because I always wonder about that. We look at the African-American influence on our culture, and it's so huge and so evident in the pop culture, just for starters, not to mention all the rest. How do you see the imprint of Native Americans on the broader American culture? How would you define it?
Right now, the relationship with the earth, the respect of a subsistence culture. You know, we live under subsistence, where you used every part of what you captured and grew and that you didn't waste, because wasting ensured your destruction. So I think when you start talking about the modern environmental movement, you're talking about a very strong indigenous influence.
But
Al Gore is an Indian.
Okay, but I think I've heard you over the years, though, sort of be dismissive of some of the looking to the Native American as the wise earth guru for the country. Have I got that wrong? Isn't it?
I'm talking about us in contemporary terms. We're just as wasteful as everybody else. I'm talking about the overall culture and the ways in which we have lived previously. And subsistence living and environmentalism are not exactly the same thing. We live subsistence levels because we had to, and our relationship with the earth is not exactly the same. I mean, we kill things. We worship the salmon because we ate it. And I think that's slightly different than this sort of touchy-feely romantic environmentalism. That's what I don't like being connected to us. To quote the poet, our environmentalism is red in tooth and claw.
What do you make of the big casino movement? I mean, that is now a great association with Native Americans. Casinos and gambling, is that the Native American fingerprint, part of it?
Oh, man. I think that's proof of that we're mainstream now. The Indian Wars are officially over. I was in the Michigan in a casino, the Soaring Eagle Casino in northern Michigan this spring, and Jay Leno walked through the lobby as I was checking in.
Yeah.
And as soon as I saw him, I thought, yep, it's over. We've completely assimilated. We're as mainstream as you can get.
Oh, boy. Let's get a call from Tarek in Providence, Rhode Island. Tarek, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I tuned in a little bit late, but I'm really intrigued by this idea of violence and how to become civilized, it's really an uncivilized process. The HBO television show Deadwood kind of shows how to become a civilization, violence always seems to be at the root of any civilization. And I just I was intrigued by how assimilation goes both ways, violence goes both ways, that this may be so basically human to be violent that we almost miss it.
Sherman, what do you say?
Yeah, earlier in the program, a thought came into my head, and I didn't say it, but the thought that in my head was, human beings don't go to war because we have to. We go to war because we want to. And so I think it is a basic human desire to commit violence, and the measure of who we are is our ability to distinguish between whether that violence is necessary or not. And by and large, it's probably not. But that said, I think about self-defense. If somebody broke into my house and came for my kids or my wife or me, I would eat their liver. But I would consider myself a pacifist. So obviously there's a huge contradiction inside myself in terms of violence. And I don't think a whole lot of Americans and a whole lot of people around the world admit to those contradictions.
What do you think as a Native American when Tarek uses the phrase to become civilized?
What did Gandhi say about Western civilization? I think it would be a good idea.
we'll leave that one at that. Tarek, thanks for your call. There was a moment, interesting moment in the Republican debate this week, Sherman Alexie, when Native Americans were suddenly, unexpectedly on the stage. Wolf Blitzer asked the presidential candidates if English should be the official language of the country. Of course, the Senate voted yesterday to say yes to that. But Senator John McCain of Arizona said he thinks it would be fine to make English the official language, but chose also to invoke his state, Arizona's, relationship with Native Americans. Let's listen.
I would like to remind you that we made treaties with Native Americans, such as the Navajos in my state, where we respect their sovereignty, and they use their native language in their deliberations. It's not a big deal, but Native Americans are important to me in my state.
Okay, he's a politician. He needs votes and support, and they live in Arizona. But I don't know if you saw it, Sherman, but what did you think of suddenly Navajos popping up in the middle of a 2007 American debate on the culture, the English language, immigration?
John McCain has been amazing for Native Americans, especially in his state. There is a strong streak of pro-Native American thought in Republican Party. There always has been. The finest president in terms of Native rights and victories in courtrooms was Richard Nixon. So that's how bad Indians have it, that we fondly remember the Nixon administration.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's an easy thing to say in Arizona or among Navajos because it's a huge voting block and they do speak their language in large numbers. But when you're talking about Native Americans in general, you're talking about 99.9% literacy in English. So it's really sort of a romantic, I want the Navajos to vote for me inside my own state, you know, comment by McCain.
Right. Let's get a last call from James in Cambridge, Massachusetts. James, you're on the air with Chairman Alexei.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering if the author's impression of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian and John Nahart's The Cycle of the West as far as their interpretation of the Native American Indian?
I mean, you know, pretty much. I mean, Cormac McCarthy's a great writer. You know, everybody in his books is hyper-violent. So, you know, in a sense of flight, my novel, I think I'm actually less violent than Cormac McCarthy is in his novels. And Nahart, I think Nahart gets a little romantic about Native Americans. You know, we were committing acts of violence and colonialism against each other long before Columbus ever showed up. So I get a little worried when people place Native Americans on a higher moral plane than anybody else, and I think Nahart's guilty of that.
Sherman Alexei, we just got you for another minute. One day your sons will grow up and maybe read this book, Flight. They launched it in part by asking you about, you know, who are the good guys in all this trouble and violence. What's the message you hope they take from the book once they finally read it?
You know, there's no real way to control who the good and bad guys are outside yourself, but you can really make sure that you don't pick up a gun.
Simple as that?
That's what I have for them.
You're a big anti-war guy these days.
I was a much bigger anti-war guy before. I mean, I'm anti-Iraq war, mm-hmm. but certainly I wouldn't have been anti-World War II. So it really depends on the threat, and I just don't see the same kind of threat here.
And Native Americans finally getting more fully at home in this, not I won't say country, but this culture that they found themselves landed in?
Generation by generation. We become more and more assimilated and more a part of the culture, and at the same time, we remain ourselves.
Well, it's an amazing journey that you take young Zitz on back through so much of that history, and we're very grateful to you for sharing it with us. Sherman Alexei, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Sherman Alexei, he wrote 10 Little Indians, The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fist Fight in Heaven. His latest novel is Flight. We'll go out with Reservation Blues from the soundtrack of Smoke Signals. He wrote it along with Jim Boyd. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.